Good evening, and welcome to the 18-hour shiur. We are now at shiur number 16, I think, out of the 19 shiurim filling this day of learning. I had a list of thank yous that I wanted to make sure to include, but apparently they disappeared a couple of classes ago from the lectern. So I will do it from memory and hope that I don't forget anybody. I wanted to thank Or Chaim for hosting. I wanted to thank Peter for doing the webcast. I also want to thank two of our main sponsors for the day, the Weinbaum Foundation, as well as David and Serena Kashitsky, who are sponsoring in memory of Riva Kashitsky, Zichrona Levracha. This particular class is sponsored, as you see on your source sheets, by Yechiel Coleman, the Gene C. Coleman Family Law Center. Thank you very much. More about that, actually, in a moment. But I also wanted to note that this is part of an overall program. This 18-hour marathon is part of a program to help fund our programs for university students. The programs for university students run here for the male students every morning and for the female students over at Ulpanat Orot. If you know of a university student who might be interested in coming to learn with us, we have students from York, U of T, Ryerson, and even some of the other schools. Give them our information, give me their information. I'll be glad to reach out. This is something that we consider a very important part of what we do. I said I was going to come back to Yechiel on this. So when I talked to Yechiel initially about this particular session, and I thank you very much for dedicating it. I said, what do you think would be a good topic? I had offered a topic. I don't remember what I had mentioned anymore, but he didn't like that topic. He said, how about reporting child abuse? And I'm not sure what I was thinking in, knowing that I was going to be telecast and that it was going to be I didn't know at the time that it was going to be my seventh of the day. No, eighth of the day. So I hope that what I say is going to be correct. It's certainly a very sensitive topic, and not one that can be taken lightly. And I urge people, as I always urge people, to please speak to their rabbis before there's ever a case, before there's ever an issue, to find out what, from a Jewish law perspective, what guidance they give, aside from speaking to your lawyer, to find out what the guidance is in terms of secular law. I read through many, many different articles on this topic, and a whole host of them that are really quite fascinating. And if anybody wants reading on it, I'd be glad to recommend. We begin with two opening texts which seem to put us in a bind. The first one from Ontario's Child and Family Services Act 1990, Section 72. It's source number one on your sheets. By the way, any lawyers who want to get credit for this, please make sure that you sign in. If you don't sign in, I can't confirm that you were here. Despite the provisions of any other act, if a person, including a person who performs professional or official duties with respect to children, has reasonable grounds to suspect one of the following, the person shall forthwith report the suspicion and the information on which it is based to a society. And then they go on with the child aid societies and they enumerate some of the things that might lead one to make such a report. And this creates an obligation which is not exclusive to people who happen to work with children. They are mentioned here, but it's not exclusive to them. There is an overall obligation to report for anybody any suspicion that abuse of children is going on. That's what's stated right here, black and white, within the Act. If you take a look at source number two, you find the Rambam, Maimonides. Maimonides writes, Asur limsur Yisrael biyad goyim. Bein begufo, bein mamo, no. One may not hand a Jew to the control of the nations, whether physically or financially. Va'afilu haya rasha ubal averos. Even if he's a wicked person, even if he's a sinner. Va'afilu haya meitzer lo umitzaro, even where he causes him trouble and pain. V'chol amoser yisrael biyad goyim. And if you turn a Jew over to the nations, bein begufo, bein mamo, no. Whether in terms of his person, whether in terms of his money, ein lo chelak la'olam haba, you have no share in the next world. Now, it's important to understand the background in which Maimonides is writing this. Jews, as a minority, like every minority, have been vulnerable to the governments of the lands in which they have resided, whether those governments were Greek, whether they were Roman, whether they were Babylonian, you name it, it didn't matter in ancient history, or more modern times, you name your country on earth. As a minority, we had no power. As a minority, we were used for whatever we could provide, and then either kicked out or abused in some other way. It's not only Jews who have experienced this, although we do seem to have had more than our fair share in terms of the go-rounds of being expelled from countries and so forth, but not just as a treatment of the population as a whole, but treatment of individuals. The reality is that there are story after story after story regarding individuals who were destroyed by the government on any pretext, and the pretext really didn't need to have anything to do with anything remotely legal. It was simply the government's decision. And so he says, don't turn somebody over to the government. Don't give them the power to harm somebody else. You're killing the person. You're condemning them to whatever the government chooses to do. So that creates a tremendous tension within the Jewish community. The suspicion of government, the concern that you turn somebody over to the government, they could be destroyed, even if they are innocent, on the one side. And then on the other hand, you have a rule here, a rule which I would hope we are all sympathetic to, which says that if you suspect that a child is being harmed, you have to report. Now, it's worth noting, and I'm going to stress this a few times, I expect, in the course of the hour, that it doesn't say, in source number one, that you report to the police. What you report to is called a CAS, a Child Aid Society. I am explicitly stating right now, I am not going to be discussing whether the Child Aid Societies do their job well or not. That's not part of the conversation. Number one, I'm not an expert in it. Number two, it's not the point. The question I am dealing with is, assuming that the system is run properly, assuming that this is a fair system of proper investigation and so forth, what do you do if on the one hand you have Maimonides, and he's not the only one, he's based on passages in the Talmud, and it goes forward into the Shulchan Aruch, into the Code of Jewish Law, and into Responsa, saying you can't turn somebody over, versus on the other hand, a law that says you better turn them over. So we need to discuss the following questions. Number one, within the Child and Family Services Act, what is the duty of a regular citizen and what is the duty of a lawyer in reporting child abuse? That's the first question. Second question, with its history of difficult relationships with government, does Jewish law recognize the duty to report child abuse to a secular government? And then a little bit of a third question. If I had more time, I would do more with the third question. If Judaism does generally require reporting, would Judaism respect solicitor-client privilege and not report? There is such a concept as solicitor-client privilege. That which comes up in conversation between the lawyer and the client is not to be divulged unless the client says so. What if Judaism says you have to report people? Will Judaism respect solicitor-client privilege? Or will Judaism say the obligation to report overrides this privilege that is recognized by the law? Those are the three questions that I like to address. We begin with the first. The duty of a regular citizen and the duty of a lawyer. So, as defined in the Act itself, if you take a look at source number 3 from the Child and Family Services Act, section 1, the paramount purpose of this Act is to promote the best interests, protection, and well-being of children. Right? Motherhood and apple pie. There's absolutely nothing to disagree with in that line. We want to promote the best interests, the protection, and the well-being of children. We want to protect them from abuse. How do you define abuse? What exactly constitutes abuse? So in that same section, I thought I had wrote it on the sheet, but I see I didn't. It's in section 72. It's not here on the sheet, but it's the same section that I quoted in source number 1. It defines abuse, neglect, emotional harm, to include physical harm, whether we're talking about violence, whether we're talking about sexual abuse, as well as non-treatment of a physical condition. The child has some kind of physical condition and parent, guardian, whoever it is not taking care of it. Emotional harm or non-treatment of an emotional condition, as well as abandonment. those are within the parameters of abuse, neglect, emotional harm. By the way, if you have a question at some point, stop me and ask, not only because I always say that, but because, you know, it's number 8 for me today and I could use it. If someone has a question, I would welcome it. The basic obligation of reporting, as I said before, is to report to a Children's Aid Society, not to report to the police. If you know something has happened, you have reason to believe something has happened, or there is an expectation that it could happen. Sorry?
That's not way too far.
I mean, that's the law.
The law doesn't say it.
If you have an expectation that it could happen...
If it might happen, you can't report it unless it actually happens.
So, the law actually states that if you believe that this is going to happen, along the lines of the same evidence that you believe that something has happened, if you are of the belief that something is going to happen, then yes, you have an obligation to report. I understand that. The law is proactive.
Let me ask you a question. You're saying who it applies to.
Yeah.
It does not apply to a regular individual. He has no requirement under law to report anything.
So actually he does. Absolutely not. Take a look at source number 1. No, including, I'm sorry, when it comes to child abuse, it is actually every individual. This is unusual for the law, because you're correct that the law in general does not have in Ontario a duty to rescue. Normally in Ontario, unless I have a relationship, a duty of care of some kind with another individual, I'm not obligated. I don't have to stop my car. I don't have to pour water on a fire. That is correct. However, when it comes to child abuse, the Child and Family Services Act says it. It's black and white in source number 1. If a person, including a person who performs professional or official duties, but it's not exclusive to them by any stretch of the imagination. It's any person. Michael.
A lot of times... when there's this kind of obligation, it's not every person, but they single out a specific group.
Correct.
A lot of times it will have a particular consequence.
Yes.
For the person in the more specific group, whereas any person... you might not be punished. I don't know. I defer to you on that.
Right. No, and that's 100% true. So, for example, I wasn't going to get to it yet, but it was coming up shortly. Take a look at source number 5. Ontario's Child and Family Services Act, 725D, subsection 4, applies to every person who performs professional or official duties with respect to children, including, and item D is a solicitor. They list doctors, they list others as well. But that's only to say that they have a special responsibility. It is not to exclude all the others. They are meaning that when it comes to child abuse, yes, it is a duty for every citizen.
If you look at one, yeah. Just one word. I don't agree with you. Absolutely
okay.
Not apply to anyone that matters. I know the fact that I deal with this stuff. The word is with respect to children. That's what applies to. If you have some position with respect to children, then only then
including that. It says including that person.
Okay, that's not true.
I am glad that I do not deal with this stuff, but I read paper after paper after paper on this, and it's every citizen.
You have a neighbor and somebody sees something, you're not responsible.
I'm sorry, but it's just not true. It's just not true.
Respect the children.
Yeah, no, but that's just part of the
clause.
It's not
a part of that clause. It doesn't mean it's exclusive to those who deal with children.
I mean, if you want, I could send you an awful lot of material on this. It all says it. It's fairly straightforward that this is everybody. It's unusual for Ontario, but in this particular case, that's the reality. Now, the Ontario Ministry of Children and Youth Services is the institution which is responsible to implement the Child and Family Services Act. So, what they say is that reasonable grounds means, and I think I brought it here on the sheet in number 4, yes? What are reasonable grounds to suspect child abuse or neglect? It is not necessary for you to be certain a child is or may be in need of protection to make a report to a CAS. Reasonable grounds refers to the information that an average person using normal and honest judgment would need in order to decide to report. Notice, by the way, that it's future reference and not only past. It's also about the child being in need for the future. But it's an average person using normal and honest judgment. On the one hand, I like that because it's a simple common sense definition. On the other hand, it's entirely unworkable. meaning that this is one of those areas where the person who actually gets the information is living in a gray area and doesn't know what in the world to do. I'm walking down the street at night. I hear, you know, a parent shouting at a child in the house. Does that mean that there's emotional harm being inflicted? Does that mean that the parent has no control of anger and could be causing physical harm to the child? Does it mean I heard a television that was too loud? Does it mean that someone's acting for a play? Does that mean that somebody has a screaming fit? That doesn't mean he's an abuser. It means that he had a screaming fit. The problem is you're fundamentally dealing with an area in which it's impossible to give hard and fast guidelines. And the only realistic guideline you can give is be a reasonable person, but that's not the hardest thing to implement. Be a reasonable person is not, you know, is not so easy. So what they state in this law is that you're supposed to report to this Children's Aid Society, and only the Children's Aid Society is authorized to investigate. Meaning it doesn't go to the police to investigate, it goes to the Children's Aid Society. It also means that the person who observed, the person who found this out, is not supposed to investigate. You, when you find out, when you hear something, when you see something, whatever it is, it's not for you to say, now I'm going to go investigate this and decide whether or not the person is guilty and whatever. You're supposed to turn it over to the people who are trained as experts. That's what the law expects. And yes, the solicitor has a special duty, and that's what we saw in source number 5. The special duty of the solicitor. Now, this special duty is in a particular case. If you take a look at source number 6. A person referred to in subsection 5. Subsection 5 is the one that broke out particular people as having a special responsibility. So it says, a person who is referred to in subsection 5 is guilty of an offense if, A, he or she contravenes subsection 1 or 2 by not reporting a suspicion, and, keyword and, B, the information on which it was based was obtained in the course of his or her professional or official duties. Meaning, in the event that you don't report it as a regular person, that's a problem. But you don't trigger you're a lawyer and didn't, you're a solicitor and you didn't report it, unless you got the information when acting as a lawyer. If you got the information while taking a walk one evening, that wasn't in your role as a lawyer. That's in your role as a regular citizen, and then it doesn't come under this particular offense. It's just a general obligation at that point. It also doesn't apply, and this is the last source in this section, source number 7. It doesn't apply to solicitor-client privilege, and that's the point that I made when I worded the questions in the beginning. It says, nothing in this section abrogates any privilege that may exist between a solicitor and his or her client. So that you have the following scenario. The lawyer is counseling a minor. The minor says something to the lawyer about child abuse that's going on. The lawyer wants to report it to the Children's Aid Society. Is the lawyer able to say anything? Lawyer can't speak up. Lawyer says to the kid, you know, what's happening to you is terrible. I'd like to be able to tell somebody responsible who can help. The child says, no, I don't want you to say anything. What's the lawyer's recourse?
Nothing.
Lawyer has no ability whatsoever to say anything. It's solicitor-client privilege. What's the... Yeah?
What's the definition of child?
The definition of child for this statute? That's a good question. I don't actually know. At what age does one reach majority for this purpose? Is it 18? Okay. 18. Thank you.
Age of majority is 18, but the Children's Aid has to bring their first application prior to the 16th birthday.
What is that? Why is that? In other words, that you
statute says
right, but is there
start a child protection case once the child turns 16?
Why?
Even though because it says so in the statute.
I understand that. I have examiners that cause it. I get it. But, what was the person writing the statute thinking?
That someone between the ages of 16 and 18 is in that hybrid area where they might have some rights of their own and some rights under child protection.
But then why not stop the law at the age of 16? Just to enable you to continue to prosecute somebody who had been doing it all along, maybe?
Because there are children that are society wards and crown wards at age 15, age 16, 17, 18, and the Children's Aid Society is mandated to render services to those children and tell
So for some purpose, it is useful to keep them within the parameters of this law.
Okay. Okay. So that's all the secular law perspective. What happens when you get into the realm of halacha, into the realm of Jewish law? So I'm going to discuss specifically the issue of sexual abuse as opposed to the broader discussion of other types of abuse and neglect and so forth. As you will see, this is a large enough discussion in its own right. So what is very clear and is not subject to debate, which is rare within Jewish law, but what is very clear is that Jewish law prohibits all forms of abuse of children, certainly sexual abuse, and has severe penalties for it. I brought you a quote here in source number 9 from Moshe Halberstam, Mesira l'shiltonut b'misha mitolel b'yeladav, which translates to turning someone over to the government if he is abusing his children. He says, v'zos l'modai, be it known, this sinner, harehu garua min hamoser v'hametzaeres harabim, he is worse than the moser. Moser is the term for somebody who turns people over to the authorities. So a person who is an abuser is worse than a person who turns people over to the authorities. He is worse than somebody who causes pain to the community. El harehu rodef achar ha'erva, he is pursuing erva. Erva means literally that which is normally covered. He is pursuing sexual violation of this child. Shem mitzvah al kol adam lahatzilas hanirdaf b'nefesh harodev. It is a mitzvah to save the intended victim by taking the life of the pursuer. If you could execute him to prevent him from doing this to the child, that would be the mitzvah. Ola mitzvah gedola techashiv lo, it would be considered a great mitzvah for him. And mind you, he goes on to say, we can't do that. He's not now licensing people to say, my rabbi told me to go kill this fellow. But what he is saying is he's trying to underscore the understanding that from a Jewish law perspective, the abuser is a rodef. He is pursuing the child to harm the child in the worst way. And yes, there would be justification for taking his life under strict law. That's number one. Number two. Jewish law is very clear, far more clear than you see in Ontario law, in terms of the duty to rescue. The requirement to intervene on behalf of somebody in need, as he stated, if you take a look at source number 9, to give one of the best examples of it, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Minayin l'roa es chaveru shu toveya banahar, o chaya gorarto, o listin boyin olav, shu chayev lahatzilo. How do we know that if you see somebody drowning in a river, you see somebody being dragged by a beast, you see somebody being attacked by bandits, how do you know that you are obligated to rescue? Talmud Lomar, the Torah says, Lo sa'amod al dam reyecha. You can't stand by while somebody's blood is being shed. You have an obligation to intervene, and that is a duty to rescue, and it is across the board a duty to rescue, not limited to abuse by any stretch of the imagination. We've discussed it in other circumstances when we had classes on confidentiality issues and so forth. Judaism has a very clear obligation to intervene on behalf of others. But there is a major obstacle in Jewish law to reporting abuse in our day where it could lead to serious penalties. And the problem is that our courts lack proper jurisdiction. And the means, meaning our courts, a Beit Din, a rabbinical court, lacks the jurisdiction and the means to sentence a criminal. And when I say that, it's not only jurisdiction in the sense that the courts of the land will not recognize Jewish courts in family law, although that is true, and not just in family law, but Jewish courts do not have criminal prosecution powers to be able to carry this out. But aside from that, Jewish law has a very high bar for evidence to prosecute a criminal case. It's really difficult within a Beit Din, within a Jewish court of law, to actually punish somebody. You require witnesses. The witnesses have to warn the person who's going to commit the crime. The person who receives the warning has to say, I know and I'm doing it on that condition, and then go and carry it out. It's a bizarrely high standard, in addition to which you cross-examine the witnesses, and the judges in a capital case are instructed that they have an imperative of saving the defendant. It's all very difficult. And then, even if you had proper evidence, proper witnesses, and everything else, add to that the fact that within the context of Jewish law, you require a certain type of judge to be able to punish. What you require is somebody who is a samuch, somebody who is ordained. What we have today as ordination is not true ordination. It does not license rabbis today to carry out this sort of thing. The type of ordination we're talking about was eradicated by the Romans in the 5th century Common Era. There's a blip in the 16th century where there's an attempt to resurrect it, but basically there is no system of classic ordination, and therefore Jewish judges, even if they had all the evidence and had all the warnings and everything else and were empowered by the government, still wouldn't be able to carry out judicial proceedings. So the question fundamentally is that you're telling me that we have to punish abuse and we have to prevent abuse and we have to intervene and so forth. How are we going to do that in an environment in which our courts cannot function? What's going to justify saying, well, let's turn them over to the secular authorities and they're going to take care of it? So the answer, at least in terms of what I have researched and what I've come up with, is that we have four different frameworks that are offered by authorities in Jewish law to justify and require turning over the alleged abuser to the CAS, to the Children's Aid Society. Four different legal arguments that are brought to say this is what one is supposed to do. One of the documents I found was incredibly useful, incredibly helpful. It's a set of papers called Kuntres Dam Reyecha. It's available online. I thought I was going to put the link to it on the sheet, but I see that I did not. But if anybody wants it, it can email me afterwards. I would be glad to send you a link to find this online. It collects tshuvos. It collects responsa on this topic from Rav Tzvi Gartner of Machon Yeshurun, Rav Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, Rav Moshe Halberstam of the Das Eid HaCharedis, who I quoted before, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, Rav Asher Weiss, and Rav Yehuda Silman of Kahal Hasidim B'nei Brak. And all of them wrote at length on this topic, and all of them said, you absolutely must report. They weren't dealing with the Children's Aid Society because they're in B'nei Brak, or in various other jurisdictions. But all of them, to the one, said that you have to report. The only variation between them was in the legal argument that brought them to that point. So I want to take you through the four different arguments that are brought. The first argument is that even though I just spent a couple of minutes informing you that you're prosecuting people in Jewish courts of law is an extremely difficult thing to do, there's a get-out-of-jail-free card, or perhaps better to say, put-in-jail-free card, that the courts have. Jewish courts are licensed to punish in a way that you would call in English extrajudicial. There are ways in which they are able to carry out penalties on people that are not within the normal functioning of a court in terms of its basic rules. If you take a look at source number 10, a passage from the Talmud in Sanhedrin. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov said, Shamati shebeis din makin ve'onshin shalom min haTorah. I have learned that the court, the rabbinical court, may strike and punish without the Torah's authorization. V'lo lavar al divrei Torah, not in order to transgress Torah, ela kedei lasos siyag la Torah, but rather to make a fence to protect the Torah. This is a Gemara here in Sanhedrin, it appears in Yevamos as well, that the courts are able to carry this out, and it is brought as a statement of Jewish law by the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, who we're going to come back to later. It's brought in the Beis Yosef of Rabbi Yosef Karo and Choshen Mishpat Shin Peches, and it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch, which is what I chose to bring on the sheet. In source number 11, the Code of Jewish Law. Kol Beit Din, every rabbinical court, afilu einem smuchim be'eretz Yisrael, even if they don't have the proper ordination that is needed. Im roim sha'am prutzim ba'averos, if they see that the nation is lawless, v'shut tzarech shah, and there's an immediate need, hayudan in bein misa bein mamon, they would judge cases, capital cases, financial cases, bein kol dinei onesh, or any punishment matter, v'afilu ein b'davar edus gemura, and even if they don't have the complete type of testimony that we normally want. And not only that, v'imhu ilem, what if the defendant is a strong guy, and he says, I'm not going to listen to you, you can't do this to me? They would go to the non-Jewish community and they would get people there and they would carry out what the Jewish community was too weak to do. There's always somebody bigger you can bring in who's going to take care of the job. That's the statement of the Code of Jewish Law, and it empowers the judges to go beyond the normal process and the normal evidence that you're that we're usually familiar with. And this has been used. I bring you source number 12, which I have to say, when I first saw it, I was shocked to realize that this is an old issue within the Jewish community, and it's older than this particular responsum. But I think it tells you something. It's from the 19th century in Poland, from the Sholom Yeshiv of Yosef Shaul Nathanson. Bishnas Tav Reshut Gimel. He tells the story of how in 1853, the following happened. Be'ir Echad Nishma Kol Amalamed Echad. There was a certain city in which the word got out about a particular teacher. Shem is Gorir Shem Zeshvona Shanim. He had lived there for 8 years. Vayeladim Asher Lam. The kids who had learned with him when they were minors, now they're 13 years old and older, they testify that when they were kids and they learned with him, he had molested them. He had molested the kids. 1853. And what did they do in this case? The Shaul Umeshev says, of Yosef Shaul Nathanson says, based on Rabbi Moshe Isserles, that where you can't have good witnesses, we make do with what we have. They punished him. That was the, they carried it out. And they said, because you're justified in doing so, to punish somebody extrajudicially where it is necessary. There are all sorts of cases that are brought in which the extrajudicial method of punishment was brought to bear. This isn't the only one by any stretch of the imagination. So that's one set of grounds for reporting. You say, you're right, our courts couldn't do anything nowadays. However, our courts, if they were to resort to the extrajudicial method, would have the ability to operate. Let the secular court function in that capacity, like our court acting extrajudicially. Okay, that's method number one. Clear? Second approach is to say, I don't need a court in order to sentence this person, because this person is a rodef. This person is currently considered a pursuer of children. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, records in source number 13, a rule with which you may be familiar, Matzilin Oso Afilu B'Nefesh HaRodef. If X is pursuing Y to kill him, and sexual abuse may fit within this category as well, the rule is you kill the pursuer in order to save the life of the intended victim if you need to do so. This is not only when he's actually in the act of pursuing. This applies even when he's not in the act of pursuing, because we are concerned for the future. That's brought in the Shulchan Aruch in Shin Pei Ches in 388, but I didn't actually bring it here on the sheet. And Rabbi Yehuda Silman, in his article on it, notes that the same may even apply to killing a Safek Rodev, somebody who might be a pursuer, but you don't actually know for sure. Now that gets you into very hot water. Potentially. Because, as was suggested before, how do you know what he's going to do? What do you mean you're not sure? This is actually a debate I've quoted in other contexts. If you were at the Shiur on treating terrorists, and there it was in the discussion as well. What do we do with somebody who we think might attack, but we don't know for sure whether he would attack? The case is discussed by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach in terms of the Torah's law of breaking and entering. The rule is, as stated in the Torah, that if somebody breaks and enters into a house, the homeowner, this takes us into stand your ground territory, but the homeowner is in fact entitled to kill the person who breaks into the house, on the assumption that the person who broke into the house saw him first, he would kill him. So you're allowed to defend yourself. Shlomo Zalman Orbach looked at that and said, well, you don't know for sure. You don't have definite proof. Maybe if he saw you, he would turn and run. Maybe what you should do is surrender whatever money it is, let him take whatever he's going to take, rather than kill somebody unnecessarily. And the fact that we don't say that, the fact that we say you are entitled to kill the person who breaks and enters, shows that where you have evidence that biases you to believe that this person would in fact kill, or in the case that we are dealing with, that this person would in fact abuse, he is considered to be a rodef, he is considered to be a pursuer right now. And I think all of the responsa that I mentioned before from that kuntras, from that set of responsa that I quoted, I think they pretty much all of them noted the reality, unfortunately, the psychological reality, that when you're dealing with people who are sexual offenders and abusers of children, it's not something that they do once and that they're done with. These are people who are ill and will continue to be ill. Maybe treatment can work, maybe you can't, but without it, no luck whatsoever. And therefore, the person who is known to have done this before is presumed to be somebody who will also do it again. That's the presumption, and therefore authorities say, I don't need a court in order to hear this case and so on. He is considered to be a rodate right now, and not only that, take a look at source number 14. He's dealing with this law of the person who is pursuing others to harm them, and he says, v'ein p'nai l'hasros bo, if there's no opportunity to warn him first. Meaning, if by warning him, you would actually allow the crime to take place, because yeah, you took your time warning him instead of stopping him. Ein tzarech hasra, then no warning is required. And that's the second basis for saying that you would indeed report. Clear? First basis was saying our courts can function extrajudicially. The second one is saying that you don't need a court anyway. Third, if I can ask someone for a cup of water, please, that would be helpful. I was going to bring one up before, and then I drank it all before I got here. You're talking about the stand your ground business. Yeah.
Somebody breaks in. The American law will let you kill a person. And the Israeli, 4 or 5 years ago, changed the laws.
Right, the Shaidromi law.
Right, but
Canada, we can't. Okay. The third argument, which I find particularly fascinating in this regard, is the argument that you actually don't need a court, because you're doing him a favor. You're doing a favor to the abuser. And this is, Rabbi Yehuda Silman brings this from the Nesivos, from Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum, as well as the Chasim Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, and Choshen Bishpat Kuvayin Zayin, and others. Take a look, please, at source number 15. Rabbi Lorberbaum notes, Kol Adam Mitzuva Lahafrish Chaveru Me'isser. Every individual is instructed to separate others from sin. Even if you are not, thank you very much, even if you are not functioning as a court right now, even if you are not functioning as a court right now, you're not a Beit Din, you're not a court of law, doesn't matter. You're supposed to separate people from sinning. There is a long tradition, Talmudically, of compelling people to comply with Jewish law. Right, kofin oso, forcing people to comply with Jewish law. Certainly then, you have the ability to compel somebody not to violate Jewish law. And if the way to compel him not to violate the law is by turning him over to the authorities, then turn him over. Let them prevent him from committing this transgression. And especially because the secular system has changed over the centuries. The concern that we always had, which we're going to come back to shortly, for Mesira, the concern that if you hand somebody over to the secular courts, you're actually you're exposing him to all sorts of harm that may not be deserved, that whole principle doesn't apply when you're dealing with the system and the structure that you have in civilized countries today. Now, again, I note that some may object to the workings of the CAS and say that that things aren't being done properly. I am not sophisticated enough to know that. But Rav Asher Weiss makes this point, Rav Elyashiv makes this point, Rav Zvi Gardner makes this point. All of them make this point to say, now, are you kidding? He'll get a jail cell. Right? If this is actually, if he's found to be guilty and goes through the entire process, he'll get to put on tefillin, he'll get to have kosher food. It's not as though somebody's going to kill him. And Rav Gardner makes the point. He says the government's going to give him counseling and rehab. What more do you want for this person than what he's actually going to get? Take a look at Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Asher Weiss, I quoted you in source number 16, makes this point. He quotes an earlier responsum from the work called Panim Me'iros. Panim Me'iros dealt with the case of turning over a thief to the government, where the government was going to kill him. And we, of course, in our law, would not kill a thief. And so the Panim Me'iros said, you can't turn over a thief to a government that's going to execute him. We don't recognize that as a legitimate form of punishment. So on that, Rav Asher Weiss makes the point Yesh lomod midvarav. Let's learn from the words of the Panim Meiros. Dima im ba'adam ha'chashud b'gneva hitir misira ilo mishum chashash hariga. If you had somebody who was suspected of being a thief, if not for the fact that you were afraid that they were going to kill him, it will be okay for you to turn him over. Right? If not for the fact that the punishment was going to be this outsized punishment, you could turn him over. How much more so in a case like ours? He says, where sexual abuse of children is infinitely worse than what the thief is doing, certainly you could turn him over, and they're not going to kill him. Chaim.
Doesn't this tshuva undermine the relief arguments? The whole purpose of not being able to turn him over is because we're afraid he's going to kill him, and you can't kill him. So he's not a relief.
What do you, I don't understand.
How can you say he's a relief? How can you apply that argument, that argument number two? How can you apply to this person? How can you use the category of relief to say that's one reason he can...
I don't understand. Just unpack it more for me. I'm slow already.
We said before that he's in the category of relief.
Who is in a category?
The abuser.
The abuser is a rodif, correct.
So we're saying here, his whole kavachomer is based on the fact with the ganav, you can't turn him over. But he's saying from that...
Oh, no, he's, that's not his kavachomer. Now I see. What he's saying is, the panim me'iros says, normally I would say turn over a thief. The only reason I'm saying not to turn over a thief is because the government is going to punish him inappropriately. So Rav Asher Weiss says, your abuser is much worse than a thief. And in terms of your concern for an outsized punishment, that's not going to happen here. So therefore, you do turn him over. He says you do turn him over. He's worse than the thief would be. You follow?
Okay, but the whole argument before the strong duty to rescue was based on the idea of...
Yeah.
At least an analogy to the risk of death. The risk
right.
Of harm.
Yeah, and he agrees with that.
So how does that apply here? No one's going to die as a result of what he's doing.
Why not? Oh, you mean in terms of... No, but he's making a different argument. He's not making the Rodef argument here. He could make the Rodef argument. First of all, Rodef is not only in a murder case. Rodef achar chavero, pursuing somebody else, will include various kinds of sexual impropriety. So don't assume that that's not actually going to be so. Whether it applies in each sexual case is a question requiring discussion. But note that that's a possibility. But he's not even making that argument. He doesn't need to make that argument. The argument that Rav Asher Weiss is making is simply that we would turn over people for lesser things if we thought they were going to get a fair punishment. So we're certainly going to turn them over for this. Alicia.
Couldn't we apply his logic the other way and say that, you know, so far we've seen many sources that say that he, you know, he's a rodent, maybe, you know, Rav Moshe Halberstam says explicitly that, you know, you should kill him. Could we hand him over if we know that the court is only going to give him a cell where he can put on his own and have kosher food and not kill him, if we really think that justly he should be killed?
So that's an interesting question. Do you stop short of doing what we think he should have? So my question would be, what are your alternatives? In other words...
I mean, practically, you don't have any.
Right. Right. No, but I'm saying, in other words, the fact that I'm not going to get what Jewish law would prescribe doesn't change the fact that there is value in doing this, separate from, in other words, you're right, turning him over so he gets his cell and his tefillin and everything else may not be the punishment that's prescribed for him. So I'm not fulfilling that avenue of Jewish law. But I am fulfilling the avenue of keeping him from sinning. I am fulfilling the avenue of protecting the victim. You follow? So you're right, I won't get this, but I'll get other things out of the deal. Now, all the things I just said are really very parav and straightforward within Jewish law. There's nothing terribly controversial in any of the three that I've just said. Where things get controversial is the fourth. And in all honesty, as I'm standing here on camera, and I know there are people watching at home, if I hadn't seen this written up by the big names who write this up, I would be very scared of what I am about to say. It's not my shoulders that are involved, it is shoulders that are far broader than mine. With that said, take a look at source number 17. This involves a Tana, a sage by the name of Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, as in Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, talking to a Roman police officer who is trying to catch thieves. So he says to him, Ta agmara hechi ta'aved. Let me show you what you should do. Let me teach you how you should catch the thieves. Ol ba'arba shoy lechanusa. In the fourth hour of the day, go into the pub. When you see someone drinking wine, and he's holding his cup in his hands, and he's dozing off. Inquire after him. Why is this guy sitting there in the pub, holding a cup of wine, and dozing off? If he is a young Torah scholar and he's sleeping, that means he got up early to learn, and he's been learning, you know, all along, and that's why he's now asleep. If he is a worker, so he got up early for his job. And if he works at night, you'll say, well, then why didn't people know about it? Maybe the type of work that he does is the type of work that people won't hear. He works with fine metal, pressing the metal into thin layers, and people don't hear him when he's tapping away with this little hammer. But if you can't come up with any justification for why he would be tired at the fourth hour of the day, right, 10 in the morning, ganvahu v'tafse, he's a thief. You should grab him. Criminology, forensics. I don't know what division this is. CSI Bavel. But this is how we're going to catch our thieves. Ishtama milsa be'malka. Word gets back to the government. Amru, they said, Kayana de igrasa iole have parvanka. Let the one who reads out the scroll be the one to carry it out. Hire him. Make him a police officer. With there's incredible irony in this, because Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, hides from the Roman government for 12 years in a cave, right? That whole story, that's him. Nonetheless, he becomes a Roman police officer. Asuel Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, v'katap is gan v'vazel. He's catching thieves, including Jews. Shalach le, it's a shock that there were Jews, but it's true. Shalach le Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha sends a message to him. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, if you follow the train in Tosos, may have been the son of Rabbi Akiva, which adds a whole nother political dimension to what's going on in this story. Nonetheless, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha sends the message to him. Chometz ben Yayin, vinegar son of wine. Ad Masaya Tamoser Amoshal Elokeinu La'ariga. How long are you going to give Jews over for execution by the government? They're killing us. Shalachle, he sends back Kotsamani Machalam and Akarem. I'm just getting rid of the thorns in the vineyard. Shalachle, he sends a message back to him. Yabobala Karim Biachalez Kotsav. Let the owner of the vineyard come do that. You shouldn't be the one to do that. And the story plays out. There's a longer discussion. He doubts himself. He tests himself. I'm not going into the entire long piece there, only to show you in the conclusion of this passage, Va'af Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi, Mataki HaMaisali Yadei, Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi, had the same thing happen for him. The government hires him to catch thieves. Paga Be Eliyahu. Eliyahu, as in Eliyahu, Hanavi encounters him. Amar Le'ad Masaya Tamoser Amosh Lekenel Hariga, Eliyahu Hanavi criticizes him. And he says, how long are you going to turn over Jews for execution? He says, what can I do? Harmana Damalko, that's the authority of the government. That's their order. Amarle, to which he replied, you should run away. Father ran away, you should run away. That's the passage here in the Gemara. So here you have great sages who function as police officers of the government, catching thieves, not based on witnesses, but based on his gut. You see the guy, he's sleeping, it's 10 a.m., he's not a worker, he's not a Torah scholar, what in the world could be the story? Let's turn him over to the government. So the big question is, who wins the debate? Is Rabbi Lazar Rabbi Shimon right? Or is Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha right for criticizing him? Is Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi right? Or is Eliyahu Hanavi right? Well, the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, who I mentioned earlier, from 13th century Spain, one of the greatest halachic authorities of his generation, in source number 18, sides with Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon, as does the Ritva on that Gemara and Bava Metzia, but I bring you the Rashba here, source number 18. Im ha'edim ne'amanim eitzel ha'birurim. He describes a situation in which you have designees, people who are appointed by the government to engage in this sort of police work. So if the witnesses are credible to the designees, rashayim heim liknos knas mamono onesh haguf, then the burim, the designees, are entitled to fine financially, they are entitled to give physical punishment, hakol v'ma sheyeroy lahem, all based on that which seems appropriate to them, v'zemek hayem ha'olam, and they are maintaining the world. I'm going to jump into the English because I see the time is flying here. So this upholds the world. And he says the following, very sharp statement. If you were to establish everything on the basis of biblical law, and you wouldn't punish other than the way the Torah does for injuries and the like, he says the world would be ruined. We would require witnesses and warnings and a whole system that you can't work with. You can't run a society that way. And certainly where there is government license, like in the case of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, right, where the government has said, this is what you're supposed to do. But the designees must confer in the matter and perform their deeds after consultation. And their intent must always be for heaven. They can't simply attack people because they don't like them and put them in prison. They have to make sure that they're doing this purely. That's the statement of the Rashba. The Rashba says the government is licensed to tell people that this is what you have to do. Why is the government licensed to this? It seems like it's a function of dina de malchusa dina, the law of the land is the law. That's a greater discussion in its own right. But there is a recognition that the government has the power to make such laws. And you, as a Jew, can be their agent. And in fact, turn people over to the government, and the government's going to carry out a punishment that we would never recognize. Well, then why did they rebuke him? If Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon is right, and if Rabbi Shmuel Bar Rabbi Yossi is right, if our police officers are correct, then what was the rebuke about? So Rabbi Yosef Karo quotes the Rashba to say, because on their level, for who they were as great sages, this really was not something that they should have been doing. That's the argument. And again, what is this about? Why does the government have this authority? It's dina de malchusa dina. It's the law of the land. And again, that requires its own shear to explain and to unpack that idea. That has been used practically. The Rashba that I just quoted for you in source number 18 ruled this way on a practical level. And down to our own age, the responsa have been uniform, not uniform, I shouldn't say that, but the responsa have solidly supported it. The Maharam Shik, writing a couple of hundred years ago, Choshen Mishpat Nun, talked about turning over a criminal who we wouldn't execute, but the secular government would, and said, yeah, that's what you do. Rav Wozner, in the Shevet Halevi, it's Chelik Beis Nunches, the Igros Moshe Choshen Mishpat Aleph Tzadi Beis, talk about tax auditors who catch Jews who, shocked to hear it, but they caught Jews who had been dishonest on their taxes, and the question was, can we turn them over? And the answer is yes. The answer is absolutely yes. They see the discussions there for more nuance. The Menachas Yitzchak Rav Yitzchak Weiss, in a classic responsum, it's in volume 8, number 148, talks about a Jew who knows that there's another Jew who drives dangerously. And he says, you better turn him in. He's a rodef. He drives dangerously. He's going to kill people. Of course you turn him in. There was a question back there.
Yes, yeah. I was going to ask you this. I was thinking it's number 18. Can it not be used to abrogate this idea of giving a warning or an opportunity to have an opportunity to give a warning in every case?
You mean because now the government just says turn them in?
Yeah.
So yes, I think it could really go that route. I think it could go that route. I should note, I did see an article by a Rabbi Avram Noach Teplin, who I believe is from Lakewood, New Jersey, in which he disagrees on the read of the position of the Rashba and the way to read this Gemara and its conclusion, but it seems like everybody else I read reads it differently from him. Everybody else I saw, and you're talking about more than half a dozen responses on this topic, all say that that's not the way to read it. But I agree with you. Yes, it will short-circuit much of Jewish law. And certainly protocol for handling cases. So that brings me back to our initial source in Maimonides. Because we have a long history of not trusting government, because the government abused the Jewish community. They imprisoned us for ransom. They fined people. They executed people. They confiscated assets. So what do you do with that? What am I supposed to do with that? And it's a Gemara. It's not just the Rambam. It's Rosh Hashanah Yitzayin Amad Aleph. It's Gittin Zayin Amad Aleph. So halachic authorities note that what we saw in source number 2 is not Maimonides' final word on the topic. In source number 2, he said you can't hand a Jew to the control of the nations and so on and so forth. But look at what he says in source number 19, just two laws later. He says, anyone who troubles the community and pains them may be handed to the nations to hit him and imprison him and fine him. But for an individual's pain, one may not hand him over. I don't understand. If turning him over is inappropriate, why is it okay if this fellow is harming the community, if this fellow is causing damage to the community? So one approach is the approach of the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, who says, I brought it for you, no, I didn't bring it on the sheet. The Chasam Sofer says that this stems from the Gemara in Gittin. The story in the Gemara in Gittin is that there's a sage by the name of Mar Okva. Mar Okva is being attacked by somebody who's making him miserable. And he wants to know, can I turn him over to the authorities? And the answer he's given is no. Get up early to go to the Beis Medrash. Stay up late at night in the Beis Medrash. Avoid him, and he'll disappear. That's the advice that's given to him. So Chasam Sofer says that works if you're an individual dealing with an individual. You can say work around him, avoid it, whatever it is. But when someone is harming the community has no way to duck him constantly. And therefore, you're now justified, if the guy's harming the community, you're justified in turning him in. That's the Chasam Sofer's approach on the Gemara in Gittin Daf Zayin. Rav Asher Weiss offers a different approach in source number 20. He says, the truth of the matter is that you have to look more carefully at this prohibition against turning people in. We call mesira, turning somebody in. He says, turning somebody in is not the same thing as what we call rodeif, even though that's the terminology that's often used, is that if you turn someone in, you're a rodeif, you're pursuing him to harm him. He says, it's not really quite true. You're not really a pursuer. The prohibition against turning somebody in is actually, he says, a rabbinic decree that they made to prevent people from abusing other people. But they chose where to apply it and where not to apply it. They applied it to the case where somebody is harming individuals. They didn't apply it to the case where he's harming the community. That's Rav Asher Weiss's formulation. And in a separate shiur, in an audio shiur, he said that today's society is law-abiding. We don't have this issue. So you have here four different arguments in favor of turning this person over. Argument number one, it's like carrying out an extrajudicial punishment. Argument number two is that you don't need a court to do it. He's a rodeif. He's a pursuer of the child. Stop him any way you can stop him. Argument number three, you're doing him a favor by stopping him. He's going to get treatment this way. You're helping him stop. You're helping him stop sinning. And argument number four is that the secular courts are empowered to deal with this, and Jewish law recognizes their power as seen in the Gemara and Bava Metzia. As I said, that last one is a doozy, and it can empower you to do an awful lot, and I wouldn't say it on my own say-so, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, but it has very solid weight behind it. There are certain practical differences between which approach you take, but given the lateness of the hour, I'm not going to go into that right now. I do want to make sure to note one other element here. I'm not going to get to the solicitor-client privilege, I think, but I wanted to make sure to note one other thing, which is very controversial, and I emailed Yechiel as I was doing the research and said, boy, am I going to get into trouble for this. Nonetheless, it would be irresponsible for me not to say it, so I'm gonna make sure to say it, which is the following. We are very concerned about making sure that the case is a reasonable one when we're going to turn somebody in. For two reasons. Number one, the stakes that are involved. And number two, in general, going based on umdina, based on your own assessment of a situation and not based on evidence that you've witnessed, is very dicey in Jewish law. We normally are very suspicious of people going on the basis of their estimation. If you take a look at source number 21, I'm going to say it outside, Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach, it's a classic story. He reports how, I saw a man pursuing somebody into a ruin and I ran after him and I found a sword in his hand and blood was dripping from it and the murdered man was still shuddering. And I said, what can I do? I can't execute you. I can't prove you did it. Even though you were the only one there, you're holding the weapon, dripping with blood. He didn't have a DNA test on the blood. Nonetheless, I'm stuck. We don't go based on our umdana, based on our assessment. Having said that, there are cases where we make assessments. And we will, for example, in a case in which somebody kills somebody else, we say, well, you don't need a warning if he knew that it was the wrong thing to do. If he was educated enough to know that it was the wrong thing to do, you don't need to warn him. You're going based on your assessment. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg says, based on another case which I'm not going to go into right now, he says, you're allowed to use umdana, you're allowed to use your personal assessment of a situation where you can't know what happened. If it's about determining fact, something that someone could have witnessed, then you need to actually have witnesses. But where it's about mind reading, what did he know at the time, what didn't he know at the time, what was his intention, then you couldn't go to witnesses. There are no witnesses who can tell you that. That's where you can work with your own assessment. But as a general rule, we don't like working with our assessments. So that's one reason why you have to be very careful with this. I'm going to go a little bit over time, just a couple of minutes, in the interest of making sure that I state the following clearly. The other concern is because we always have gray areas. I brought this statistic for you to see on the sheet, on the last side, source number 24. The Canadian Child Welfare Research Portal from 2008 There were an estimated 235,842 child maltreatment-related, and that's estimated, child maltreatment-related investigations conducted in 2008. That's shocking as a number to me, given that it's not a large country. Right? How many people did you have in Canada during that time? How many children did you have in Canada during that time? In that 1 year, 235,842 investigations is just shocking to me. Sorry? I don't get a breakdown. But what they say is 36% of them were confirmed for child abuse or neglect. That means that in basically 2 out of 3 cases, they were not able to confirm that something had happened. Now, failure to confirm doesn't mean there wasn't something going on. Failure to confirm means this evidence that they found did not rise to a standard where they could say, yes, there was child abuse, yes, there was neglect. I'm not claiming that there was only a 36% guilt ratio within this. What I am saying is that there's a great fear that you're reporting somebody who actually is innocent. This is you can ruin somebody's life. Granted, it's the Child Aid Society. It's not the police pulling up with sirens at the person's house. Nonetheless, going through this investigation, all the trauma that's going to come with it is really not a minor thing. So generally speaking, and here's where I'm going to get into trouble, but I feel it's irresponsible if I don't say it, the same rabbinic authorities who push turning over abusers also push for consultation with people who are expert in matters of abuse and who understand the sensitivities of Jewish law to assess whether there are grounds to report. Not in order to investigate. No one is claiming that the rabbi is going to be an investigator and is going to figure out guilt or innocence. Not in order to handle the investigation, but to assess what you heard, what do you think? Was this really? Was it not really? And to just make sure that there is really reason for concern. In the regular world, so to speak, meaning the not in the Jewish world, in the broader world, if somebody hears something outside of a house or somebody sees something in the schoolyard or whatever it is, very often they will go to somebody else and say, this is what I saw, what do you think? Am I reading too much into it? Am I not reading too much into it? And what the rabbis are saying here, I brought you with Usher Weiss in source number 25, is when you're going to do your asking, when you're going to do your consultation with somebody, make sure you speak to somebody who knows Jewish law and is going to be sensitive to the issue. I will add to that simply that if there's an imminent threat, do not pass go. Do not consult with anybody. If you think something is going on, if you think there is a child in danger, and you're going to sit there and consult, you're violating halacha. We absolutely do not go and consult when we feel that somebody is in danger right now. If you have the time to have a meeting with somebody and sit down with them, then that's what this is suggesting. I will go back to what I said to you in the very beginning. Right? This is a scary topic. And Yechiel, I'm glad that you pushed me to do the research on it, but boy, this is a very scary topic, and I'm not, I believe that one should proactively find out from their halachic authority, from their lawyer, what the expectations would be for them in their given situation before you ever hear, God forbid, about such a thing that's going on, and now you're in the situation. Find out what your protocol ought to be, but what I think I've shown and what I hope I've shown today in this, in the past hour, is the duty of the citizen as well as the duty of the lawyer to actually report to the Children's Aid Society, the position of Jewish law also being that one does report based on one of the various grounds that we've outlined, with this caveat of being so careful because you're going based on estimation, you're going based on guesswork, and you really can wreck somebody's life. You really have to be cautious about going ahead, but ultimately the brunt of the caution has to be with the children and on the side of protecting them. I hope what I said was correct. Thank you very much.